This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to a brand new show here of the Place to Be Nation, Letters from Kayfabe. I'm Parv, and I'm here with Alan. How you doing, Alan?
How are you, Parv? I'm great, thank you very much. Thank you for letting me be involved with what should be an absolutely fun series of podcasts we've got planned.
Absolutely, and I am pumped, excited for this brand new show. I'll just briefly explain what we're doing here. Basically, Alan and I are here to talk about the WWF, the World Wrestling Federation, in its glory years. So, roughly speaking, from about 1984. And I reckon we'll get as far as, I don't know, about 96, 97. Does that sound right, Alan?
Yeah, I think that's what we would define as glorious. I mean, there may be listeners that say otherwise, but for our fandom anyway, and many of others as well, I think that's a good kind of time period to cover.
Yes, and really what we want to do on this show is to delve quite deep into, I guess, the universe of the WWF in that time frame. You know, the deepest, darkest corners, the recesses of stuff that went on TV during that time frame. Maybe some things that happened off pay-per-view that we may have forgotten about. These are the sorts of things that we're going to be looking at. But the way we're going to do it is that we're going to be sent letters from various different fans and listeners, and we will read those letters, which will contain questions, and we will then try to answer those questions. Sound good, Alan?
That sounds wonderful. I think I have to make it akin to we're covering the edge of the cheese platter that is the WWF.
Right. So if you know, Hulk Hogan versus Andre is the big cheddar in the middle of that, we're kind of looking at the crumbs on the edges in a way.
Yep, that's it.
Yes. So without further ado, just to explain, we've got three regular features for each of these shows. And the first one is going to be the mailbag, which we're about to go to, an ever-popular feature. The second one is going to be the event center with Justin Rosero from the Place to Be Nation. He's going to pop in with little tidbits about things that were happening in this week. And then we're going to have a longer topic to round things off, also taken from fan letter. But, you know, maybe it will be something that takes some time to deal with. So that's how we're going to go. So without further ado, should we go over to the mailbag?
I think we should. I think I'll delve right in now.
We'll be back with the mailbag. Oh, and no doubt the mailbag has just arrived.
Well, if a postman delivered like that in England, I'd fire him immediately.
Our first question for this show is, Dear Alan and Parv, my favourite wrestler is Shane Douglas. I knew him mainly as Dean Douglas in 1995. I've just found out he was in the WWF earlier, in 1990. What can you tell me about this time in his career? And that's kindly written in from Chadley Crisolo from Norwich in Connecticut. So, what do you think, Parv, about Shane Douglas, his early kind of run in WWF in 1990?
Well, yes, I have gone back and I've had a little look at the sorts of things that Shane Douglas was up to in 1990. And he had quite a little run there. He won a number of different matches. I was very shocked to find one match that he had against Haku, which he won. And he was basically like a kind of a young lion during that time. Very kind of clean technical wrestler. He seemed like he was being primed for bigger and better things. Would you agree?
Oh, definitely. I would say with Shane Douglas, he had, you know, the archetypal clean-cut pretty boy look, and he seemed to have, you know, the potential there as a strong mid-card babyface kind of character. There is kind of, people have spoken about this before, and I don't know if you've heard this one, Parv, that the original character for the Heartbreak Kid was going to be given to Shane Douglas. I don't know if you knew that. It wasn't akin as much to the character that you saw in 92 and onwards. He was going to go for Vince, more of a rock star, heartthrob David Cassidy type gimmick, and Douglas at the time had that sort of look. So that's been things that, you know, has been mentioned about Shane Douglas at the time. But he had, you know, a quite interesting run, really. I mean, he didn't feature on any of the pay-per-views in 1990, but he did work dark matches for SummerSlam and Survivor Series of 1990, and he made his first pay-per-view, well, his only pay-per-view appearance for WWF in that run was in the Royal Rumble, where I think he did fairly well in that year, didn't he?
He did have a decent little run. He's a good 20 minutes, I think, in that Rumble. I mean, I watched something like 7 or 8 different Shane Douglas matches during this run. And it's not like he wasn't, you know, he was on TV fairly regularly, you know, on Superstars, on Challenge. He had an appearance at SummerSlam Fever against the Orient Express. And even in that match, I mean, that was a losing effort. But his partner there, Sonny Blaze, took most of the punishment from the Orient Express. Douglas was actually quite strong in the match. He had victories over the Brooklyn Brawler that I saw. He had a match against Paul Diamond, a pre-Orient Express Paul Diamond, which he won. He had a match against Iron Mike Sharp, which he won. Haku, which I mentioned. He had a match against a guy called the Black Demon, which he won. But then, surprisingly, he faced Dino Bravo and lost in about 2 minutes. So, yeah, it was kind of interesting to see, after all those victories, including the one against Haku, him then very quickly losing to Bravo there.
Well, Bravo was a kind of mid-card gatekeeper of sorts. I think if he'd stayed around longer, Shane Douglas, I think there would have been potential there for, you know, in a year or so, you know, an Intercontinental Championship run, or maybe, you know, a few years down the line, a King of the Ring run, when more of the smaller, lighter guys were getting more of a push in WWF due to kind of outside circumstances. But do you know why he left the WWF, Parv?
No. Why did he leave the WWF?
Well, he told Vince that he wanted to care for his dad who had fallen ill. So Vince released him from his contract. He also said that he wanted to attend medical school. He never really went to medical school, so Vince saw it as he broke his promise to him, because he turned up, it was, you know, a year later in WCW at the back end of 92 when he started the run with Ricky Steamboat, but I think there was a bit of bad will there, that Douglas kind of said one thing and did another, and that's why he was released from his contract. So maybe that was why, you know, years down the line, when he did work the Dean Douglas gimmick, he wasn't treated that well.
Interesting. Well, I mean, I thought it was quite interesting how they treated him, you know, when I was watching all these matches. Gorilla Monsoon obviously talked him up quite a lot in commentary. And they were kept on making comparisons between Shane Douglas and Mr. Perfect. They were saying that, you know, doesn't he remind you a little bit of Mr. Perfect and things like that? Bobby Heenan obviously played that down quite a bit when people mentioned it. But, it was almost like he was being positioned for something bigger. And I'm wondering why it never quite happened. Seemed like something bigger should have happened there. Didn't really work out.
Well, here's a bit of a question with Douglas for you. Do you think his run with Johnny Ace in the Dynamic Dudes in WCW, mm-hmm. Do you think the audience is that different, that a lot of people, when he turned up on WWF television, didn't have a clue who he was? Or do you think he had some sort of rub from that run the year previous?
Well, I mean, the word rub is interesting. I think the Dynamic Dudes was quite an old school. I mean, even though they were trying to be all kind of cool, they weren't very cool. And I think that idea of, you know, the young kind of, not happy-go-lucky, but kind of super clean-cut, white meat. He
can't keep still, has springs for legs,
yeah,
when he's in the ring,
yeah,
bouncing,
I mean,
up and down.
They were basically kind of, you know, you've got the Rock and Roll Express, you've got the Fantastics, even the US Express, and they were kind of a throwback to that type of team. And I think that the fans in WCW at that time kind of rejected that. And I also, I mean, one of the things I couldn't help but notice watching all of these matches is that Shane Douglas got quite a lot of boring chance. He got boring chance against the Brooklyn Brawler. He got boring chance against Haku, against Iron Mike Sharp. Virtually every match has boring chance. And I'm wondering if it's because fans were already kind of... You could no longer be just a clean-cut babyface like that in 1990.
Agree.
You know, the time had gone just to be a white meat babyface. You needed something else, and he didn't really have a gimmick.
No, he didn't. He was just he had lots of bright tights still that he wore. I do remember that, and I do remember with some of the footage I've watched and just from memory that he was put over a lot by Roddy Piper as well as some sort of kind of rookie of the year, this rookie talent. I mean, it was an interesting time, you know, 1990, early 91, because they brought him on up, and also, you know, another young rookie who was similar in some ways was Dustin Rhodes, who both left despite quite substantial rookie pushes in the WWF. And they both left over similar things, father issues. I know there were different ones, with Dusty going back to WCW. But I think, you know, with those two, they were built up a lot by WWF, and then WWF didn't get a payoff from that build.
Yes, okay. Well, I think we've... if you have anything else to add on Shane Douglas fans, write in. But why don't we move on?
Yeah, well, we'll move on to the second question we've got on this episode. And dear Alan and Parv, I grew up watching Buddy Rose wrestling in Pacific Northwest. I wasn't watching wrestling in 1990, but a lot of people said he let himself go in his later career. What sort of matches was he having? And that was sent in from Matt in Portland, Oregon. So what are your thoughts on Buddy Rose there, Parv?
He certainly did put on a lot of weight from his early... kind of late 70s, early 80s heyday. Buddy Rose was never the thinnest wrestler. I think we'd agree. I mean, but he was in excess of... he must have been about 350 pounds by 1990. And, you know, if you've seen the weight loss... have you seen the weight loss infomercial? The blow-away diet stuff?
It's a very well-done... actual infomercial.
Yeah, I think the production values are quite good on it. But it's, I mean, one of the things that interests me is that they went to the trouble of doing that, but it wasn't really for much of a push. I watched quite a few matches of Buddy Rose in preparation for this question from Matt from Portland in Oregon. And let me just give you some of the opponents that I saw him against. Coco Beware, Kerry Von Erich in his debut for the WWF, Paul Roma, Tito Santana, Jake Roberts, and a newly turned babyface Greg Valentine, and Tugboat.
Tugboat Thomas.
Tugboat Thomas. And now, not one of those matches goes more than 5 minutes, and he loses all of them.
Yeah, he didn't have the greatest win-loss record. I mean, for me, he was... the definition of, and I know some people don't like this term, including noted historian Matt Farmer, he isn't a fan of Jobber to the Stars, but to me, Buddy Rose was that person. He was, all jobbers are jobbers to the stars, but only jobbers to the stars beat other jobbers regularly. And he was that person. I mean, he did win, actually. I ran the numbers on this one, Parv, and approximately he got 19 wins from 160 dates when he did this run in WWF at the time. So out of those 19 wins, he was beating the likes of Jim Brunzel, Jim Powers, Pez Watley, Reno Riggins, Mario Mancini, Ron Cumberledge, Dustin Rhodes once. So he did pick up some wins, and some of those were on TV. But as you said, he lost more than he won.
Well, I mean, I was just thinking, you know, Coco Beware in 1990. Now, some fans would say the Coco Beware was a jobber to the stars, or that Paul Roma was in 1990. And I just thought it was interesting that Buddy Rose was below the likes of them on the pecking order at that time.
I mean, I group him in, for me anyway, is with people who had a bit more kind of national exposure with success than... Well, not even national exposure, sorry, territorial exposure than the likes of Coco, where... I mean, he had his run in Memphis, obviously. Some of the listeners of the show know how good he was in that. But I group him with people like Black Bart and Rip Oliver, Scott Casey, Porkchop Cash, Al Perez, Pez Watley, Tim Horner, Sam Houston, the list goes on and on. That type of person that came into the WWF and was kind of just there treading water.
Yeah, a couple of interesting little things about these ones that I watched is that he did get a little bit of mic time in front of some of the matches. One little business that he had quite a lot was that he wore this T-shirt saying that he weighed 217 pounds, but Howard Finkel would announce him at 317, and he would always intervene and say and correct, you know, correct the weight. And he was even doing that as late as 1991. So I think that they would, you know, that infomercial was one little thing they gave him to play with, and he kind of ran with, you know, he ran with that idea the whole time, which is quite interesting. Now, even right towards the end, he's still living that and insisting that he's lost 100 pounds on the blow-away diet. So that's one interesting thing. Because in wrestling, I'd say a year is quite a long time to be living off the same storyline effectively, or half a storyline. The other thing is that in the match against Greg Valentine, there was quite a lot of stuff around Jimmy Hart trying to win Valentine back, which I didn't realize happened. Have you seen that, Alan?
No, I've not seen that match, but he's trying to win Valentine back. How is he managing to do this? Has he brought flowers to the ring? Is he trying to woo him? What's he trying to do?
Well, basically, he keeps on coming and saying, Greg, please, please don't leave me. You can't do this. And I think what happened is that Honky Tonk Man left, and for whatever reason, Greg had turned. And maybe we'll return to this in a future show, but I just thought it was an interesting piece of business. I didn't know that Jimmy Hart had made efforts to bring Valentine back to the Hart family, whatever his stable was called, not the Hart Foundation, but you know, his stable of evil wrestlers. So,
well, not the first family anymore, but no. Did Greg Valentine have his jet black dyed hair at the time?
No, so? he was back to being in the blonde, but basically Valentine kept on chasing Jimmy back to the locker room. And then within a minute or so, Jimmy would be back trying to get Greg. But even with all of that distraction going on, he still dispatched of Buddy Rose with no problems. I also saw Jake Roberts gave Buddy Rose a DDT and pinned him with his little finger, which I thought was also, I guess it just seemed to give an indication of where Buddy Rose was at this point in his career, Matt.
I really think, though, that for people who only know Buddy Rose from this era, I really think it hurt his legacy with people who didn't know him from the Portland one. I know Matt, who asked the questions from Portland, but other people know Buddy Rose for this small run and this, the kind of infamous kind of blow-away diet infomercial mock one that they did. So I think for some people, they'll see Buddy Rose and they'll hear people talk about him as a Hall of Fame contender, this super worker, and they'll just think, hang on a minute, I've just seen him get beat by Jake Roberts on a Daily Motion clip online in 2 minutes, you know, with his finger. So we want to emphasise he was a fantastic worker, you know, less than 7 years earlier.
Yes, and well, I mean, less than, even in 1986, 87, he has some very good matches with the Rockers in the AWA. So, he's not even that far removed from the time that he was having very good matches. But I have to say, watching some of these, you know, being beaten by Tugboat in 3 minutes, when you're or Paul Roma in 3 minutes and 33 seconds, including the introductions, I had to feel for him a little bit.
I agree. But apparently, this was one of Vince's favourite things he ever did with the company at this time, was to produce this. And Vince got a kick out of this, and I don't know if you noticed this, what was written on the back of his tights, Parv, the back of Buddy Rose's tights sometimes. But he had a feeling there that it said 1-800, because this was the number you'd dial for the blowaway diet, and it was on his tights. It said 1-800-LAR-DASS, 1-800-LARDASS.
Right, okay.
And Vince used to read that and find that quite funny. So
yeah.
Vince's humour wasn't that great, and this was kind of an example of that. And, you know, Buddy Rose, great worker. I mean, he had a year run, like you said. People have had far less. So I don't feel sorry for him for this run.
Do you think that this was a kind of a message that the WWF was sending at this time, basically saying, well, you know, maybe wrestlers used to look like this, but you can't get away with being in this sort of shape, you know, at this level of competition?
Well, they kind of shamed people a few years earlier, I mean, with Adonis when he put on all that weight. So I don't think this was a new thing from Vince. I think Vince every so often would like to re-remind people that this wasn't what the kind of look he wanted on TV, and they would be ridiculed if, you know, were pushed but ridiculed in a way if they had that look. So I think that was always around. And Buddy Rose was an example in the early 90s of this.
Maybe Baston Booger might be another one when he came in 1993. There was a little bit of that, I think, with him. He was a slob, basically, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think Vince fat shames people at the time. It's not his idea of how someone should look on TV, so he'll emphasise that a lot.
Okay, well, I think time for one more question.
Have we got time to squeeze one more in? Okay, the next question then is... Dear Alan and Parv, was Nick Bockwinkle ever in the WWF? And that's sent in from Carl Harris in our part of the world, in England. So thank you very much for sending that in, Carl Harris. So what do you think? Nick Bockwinkle in WWF, Parv?
Well, it might surprise some people to know that Nick Bockwinkle was in the WWF. And he made his on-screen debut at Madison Square Garden on October the 16th, 1987. If you can actually find this footage, we'll probably put it in the show notes, because these days you can find anything on the internet. but basically on YouTube, there's a chap called Richard Land, and he has this card, the October the 16th card. And if you go to that card and you go about 17 minutes in, Bobby the Brain Heenan, who's in the commentary booth with Gorilla Monsoon, randomly says he's got an announcement to make, gets in the middle of the ring, and then gives a big introduction to his old friend, his old ally, Nick Bockwinkle, who he says has forgotten more about wrestling than he could ever learn. And then Nick Bockwinkle comes, looking dashing, as he always does. I mean, his hair is immaculate as ever. Still looks cool, and he still looks young to me. I mean, I know this is at the end of his career, but he was having matches even at the start of 1987. When is the Kurt Hennig match? Christmas Day, 86. Yeah. So not too far removed from Bockwinkle having all-time classics in the ring. And he then sits down on commentary and calls the rest of the card with Monsoon. And he's quite, I did note, Alan, he was quite conceited on commentary, throughout the rest of the, show, but he was quite measured in his analysis too. He wasn't kind of openly cheering on the villains, but he was, taking a lot of time to note how great he was himself. I'll just put it that way.
Oh yeah. Right off the bat, he matched Monsoon with, you know, counterpoints in his vocabulary as well. And he could tell with his vocabulary that he was taking the heel role. Yes. more so than Gorilla. And did you notice, I don't know if you did, Parv, during this show, that Gorilla took a stab at him by saying when Bockwinkle was introduced to the crowd, he didn't get that much of a reaction.
Yeah.
So Bockwinkle kind of responded to that by saying it's just because New York's a big city, it doesn't mean it has any class, which I thought was quite an interesting kind of way of coming back. But it was interesting that was brought up on, you know, it was acknowledged that his reaction wasn't a huge pop. And that's because he didn't work a hell of a lot in New York, so not a lot of people may have known of him.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think if you'd held the card in Chicago or in, St. Paul or one of these sorts of towns, there probably would have been a lot bigger reaction. It's just that I guess Nick Bockwinkle worked around traditional AWA country, and the AWA never ran in New York for obvious reasons. So, I think that, you know, they had a good idea. It's just, I actually wonder why they did it at Madison Square Garden. I think maybe they should have waited for a Superstars taping in or a challenge taping in that part of the world, in traditional AWA country. And I don't really see any reason why Nick Bockwinkel couldn't have had a long... He was very good in the color role, I thought. You know, I think he could have done a good job there. Maybe a little bit too cerebral for the TV product of that time. What do you think?
Well, I think so. I think Nick was, he was colourful and erudite and funny as well and witty, but I don't think in a way he fit in fully to the cartoony, in a way, buffoonery.
Yeah.
That was the better word. That was more of the hallmark of late 80s, mid to late 80s WWF. So I think he wasn't a great fit for it. But I've got a question for you, Parv, about Bockwinkel, now that he's been brought up. For me, it may have been interesting to see Bockwinkel take on the role, and you won't like this, of the Million Dollar Man.
Yes.
Which was, at the time, I don't know if you know, it was rumoured, but more in a managerial capacity. I mean, it's not that DiBiase didn't play it well, but to me, and I don't know to others, it may be more believable to have an older, long-time world champion, who guy had been at the top, you know, of the wrestling business for 20, 30 years, claiming to be a Million Dollar Man. You know, it's a different route of going down, and hindsight's, you know, wonderful. We can look back and say this, that, and the other, but that's a way that they could have gone, you know, not knowing the success that DiBiase was going to have in the future.
Yes, I know that was talked about for a long time, Bockwinkel coming in as the character, and I think they may have even offered it to him, or there was at least talk of offering it to Bockwinkel. I think he would have made a very different type of character. I think if you look at DiBiase, he's what some of us British might call the nouveau riche. You know, he's not the classiest guy, DiBiase. You know, he flaunts his money. I think Bockwinkel would have been a more kind of old-fashioned type of class.
Ah, so you're kind of equating it to kind of new money and old money, what people used to kind of call that years ago.
I think DiBiase was very much a kind of, you know, Ronald Reagan era, you know,
he's Gordon Gekko.
Yeah, Gordon Gekko. He's come into money. He's not afraid to flaunt it. I mean, it's no surprise that he was a big star at the time when they were running Trump Plaza for the WrestleMania. You know, Donald Trump was a big DiBiase fan. So you know, it's a different style of millionaire. Whereas I think Nick Bockwinkel would have been more kind of yachts on the Riviera and. You know, just a different, an old-fashioned type of class. I can imagine him there with a cocktail glass, you know.
You're right. I think, you know, it's more, you know, more akin maybe, now you've said that, to DiBiase having the role more of an in your face, rubbing it in that you've got a lot of money rather than a suave, sophisticated, rich man. Did you know that Bockwinkel, or not just you, Paul, but he was involved in the Royal Rumble in 89. And anyone who's got the network, WWE Network, or who can watch this various places online, he stuck around, as I said, to early 89, and he was a road agent at the time. And he was one of the officials that was actually attacked by the Ultimate Warrior after the Super Pose Down. And he takes a flat back bump off a chop, and he does a spill to the outside for the Warrior. So I don't know if many people picked up on that, but it's definitely there to check out.
Well, I didn't know that until today, and it kind of knocked me out a little bit when I saw that, because, you know, Royal Rumble 89 was an event I've seen many times, and I never realized until today that was Nick Bockwinkel was one of those officials there. So
It was interesting, and there's a match that I'm trying to track down, Parv, that you may get a kick out of. There's a Kurt Hennig Jim Brunzel match from, I think, very early 89, which was during Kurt's initial push, and after Brian Blair had left, so Brunzel was kind of jobbing around for years, and I think it was Ron Trongard and Nick Bockwinkel that were doing commentary, and it was basically WWF, AWA in the WWF, because you had Brunzel versus Hennig with Trongard and Bockwinkel on commentary. So I think that's quite an interesting one. I've just not tracked down that match yet.
So Bockwinkel basically ends up leaving, and then he turns up in WCW as the commissioner at some point?
No, I mean, after 89, he did go back to the AWA in 89. He was on screen there again. So the WCW thing, where he was the on-screen commissioner, didn't come actually till I think it was 1994. So right. He did have a little bit of a foray back to the AWA, and he was associated with them on and off up until their demise, really, in the early 1991. So his time as a wrestler had gone. I mean, by this point, Bockwinkel was in his 50s. But don't get me wrong, if he was given the opportunity, he could still run rings around 80-90% of the locker room.
Did he have a match at Slamboree, I want to say, against... Is it is it Billy Robinson? Dory Funk Jr., maybe?
He did have it. There was a Slamboree Legends reunion show in 94 and 93 that WCW did.
I want to say Bob Winkle was on that card.
No, you're probably right. I think they did 2 or 3 years worth of those shows. It could have been 94, 95, but it does sound about right because you had all sorts of people working on, you know, these shows that hadn't been, you know, on screen for years and years.
So he goes to a 15-minute time limit draw with Dory Funk Jr. at Slamboree.
That'll be right. Well, that's your wheelhouse, Parv, that, right there.
Dory Funk Jr. comes out with Gene Konitsky and Bockwinkle comes out with Vern Gagne. And fans will probably correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's the match where they take it from colour to black and white for the match.
Yes. No, they do, yeah. To make it even more appealing to watch for the modern fans. I mean, WCW, everybody, why would you want to date something, you know, to not the opposite of enhanced, to kind of bring it down the actual, you know, you've... what the people were watching, it's crazy. But that was basically Bockwinkle. I mean, he did the 1987, he did 2 MSG shows at the end of 87, which was the November and December ones. I think it was October and November, but he also did the Boston Garden shows and the Cops Coliseum shows, one in December. And he also did a show where he was co-commentating with Craig DeGeorge in March of 1988 at Cops Coliseum as well.
I bet he enjoyed doing that.
I bet it would have been a hoot. And then he positioned himself into being a more of a road agent role after that, which I think he would have been, you know, mighty fine. I think he would have been better than Strongbow or someone like that in that role.
God, can you imagine having Nick Bockwinkle as the road agent on your match? I think you'd be scared, wouldn't you?
You would? Well, I'd rather have him, though, than someone like the Chief. But, yeah, I think it was quite interesting looking back that there is plenty of footage out there of him in WWF doing little nuggets of things if you search it out. So I definitely recommend that to the listeners.
All right. Well, we're going to go now to our next segment, which is a report from JT Rosero, our correspondent at the Event Center. And when we come back, we've got one more topic for you.
Let's take you down to the Event Center.
Thank you, Parv and Alan. Justin Rosero here with this week's Event Center, and I hope you're all enjoying episode number 1 here of Letters from Kayfabe. Great topic coming up still on this show, looking at King of the Ring tournaments pre-1993, and kind of looking at also, you know, shows or matches where the King title actually changed. And that kind of brings me to my topic here tonight, which is looking at 1991's King of the Ring. It's the final one they did prior to making it an actual pay-per-view in 1993, and this one took place in my backyard at the Providence Civic Center in Providence, Rhode Island on September 7th. 1991. Here's the card, courtesy of the history of WWE.com. Jerry Sags defeated Road Warrior Hawk by disqualification. Ricky Steamboat and Ted DiBiase went to a 15-minute draw. Jim Duggan defeated Brian Knobbs. IRS defeated the Berserker. Bret Hart beat Pete Doherty, who was subbing for Terry Von Erich. And that's an interesting match there. I'm curious if Tornado was actually ever scheduled for that match, or if they kind of knew, you know, false advertisement, they knew he wasn't going to make it. And if he was scheduled for the show, was that really the matchup they were going to run out there? Bret Hart and the Texas Tornado in the fall of 91. Interesting. Skinner defeated Virgil. And that match always makes me laugh because I had a tape that had an Event Center for this show back in the day. And they really hyped up that Skinner-Virgil match with dueling promos. And Skinner said he was going to, you know, he doesn't care what his name is around the Everglades. He's known as Alligator Bait. So it was a pretty interesting how they decided to build up that feud. But Skinner was pretty new at that time and being prepped for a little bit of a mid-card push. Sid Justice pinned The Warlord and The Undertaker pinned Road Warrior Animal. Now, those first-round matches all were about 5 minutes or less, so not the strongest card-wise, other than DiBiase and Steamboat, of course. They went 15 minutes. Non-tournament match after that, the Beverly Brothers defeated the Bushwhackers, and in the quarterfinals, IRS defeated Jim Duggan, Bret Hart defeated Skinner, and Undertaker and Sid went to a double DQ. So IRS then defeated Sags in just over a minute in the semis, and then the finals, Bret Hart was crowned the final King of the Ring in 1991, pinning IRS around the 10-minute mark. Not a very good crowd. It was a matinee show, 2,400, and not a very good card either. No match, again, the only match over 7 minutes was Beverly Brothers Bushwhackers, the rest five or less, other than the time limit draw with Steamboat DiBiase and then the main event. So, interesting concept, and of course, these King of the Ring cards did happen often in the New England area, whether it was Providence or Foxborough, dating back all the way to 1985. They took a year off in 92 and then made it their main, one of their five main pay-per-views in 1993. And of course, Bret Hart, the correlation there, won it in 1991, won again in 1993. So always a topic that interested me, and it's going to be a great topic here to be covered on the rest of the show. Also, be sure to check out everything else PlaceToBeNation.com has to offer, whether it's here on the PWO PTBN feed, on the Place to Be podcast feed, or our PTBN pop feed, all of those available to you on iTunes. And also remember to stop at PlaceToBeNation.com first. If you're going to do any shopping over at Amazon, be sure to click that Amazon banner and then head over and do all the rest of your shopping. So be sure to tune in next week as well. Don't forget about us here, because we're going to be looking at the changing look of the WWF from the mid to late 80s. So a lot going on both in this episode and next week. I'm going to take a break. I'm going to toss it back out to my comrades, Parv and Alan. I guess my lads. I don't know. I'll have to work on that. I'm JT Rosero, this week's Event Center in the books. Take care.
All right, well, thank you for that, Justin. And you hear it from him there that we had a King of the Ring tournament in 1991 that never made it to TV. I think that leads into a question that a listener has asked. So, Alan?
Well, here we go. There's a question here. It's I remember reading in Pro Wrestling Illustrated about a King of the Ring tournament before 1993. What was it all about, and did Harley Race ever win it? And that's asked from Graham Nelson from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. So, Parv, can we answer this one for Graham?
Yes. Yes, basically, there was a King of the Ring tournament before 1993. In fact, the first one happened in 1985, and they held it every single year until 1991, which is the one that you just heard about in the event center there. And Harley Race did win it. He won the 1986 edition. Before we go on, do you have any of the actual matches there, Alan? The finals, maybe?
So, the 1985 King of the Ring, the brackets were Don Morocco, Junkyard Dog, Les Thornton versus Steve Lombardi, Paul Orndorff versus Bob Orton Jr., Johnny Valiant versus Pedro Morales, Terry Funk versus Tito Santana, Jim Brunzel versus The Spoiler, Ricky Steamboat versus Greg Valentine, and finally B. Brian Blair versus The Iron Sheik. So that's a nice hodgepodge of people in that first opening round, isn't it, Parv?
Johnny Valiant was wrestling in 1985.
Yes, Valiant.
That seems unusual. I thought he was kind of injured and retired at that point, so that's a bit of a turn up. How did the semi-finals transpire?
The semi-finals ended up being Morocco versus Morales, of course.
Okay.
Can't separate those two in the upper half, and in the lower half it was Santana versus the Iron Sheik.
Versus the Iron Sheik. So I'm guessing that one heel and one hero went through.
No, you'd be wrong, actually. Interesting booking. It was Morocco beat Morales, and then the Sheik beat Santana. Bear in mind that the Sheik... Well, saying that, actually, they were both positioned quite strongly, Santana and the Sheik in 85 still, so it was Morocco versus Sheik. It was a heel-versus-heel final, by the looks of it.
Right, and I'm guessing that there was a bit of salt involved with the finish there, in honor of a guy who's recently passed away. I'm sure Mr. Fuji would have been involved in the... In the finish there. Yes. So Don Morocco wins the tournament. I guess he was being repositioned as a big contender again.
Yeah, just to touch on it, I feel that they used the King of the Ring to build credible challengers. Like I said, for Hogan at the time, so that would have done wonders for his career. You know, him, you know, winning a tournament like this. It was promoted on TV. It wasn't televised for whatever reason. It drew well 22,000, but it was mentioned and acknowledged on TV at the time.
Well, one of the funny little things that I saw about the 1985 tournament was if you seek out on there's a promo by the Iron Sheik. about kind of hyping this, and he keeps on saying Foxborough Massachusetts he cannot say it. The name of the stadium at all. Like, then he can't say the town. It's funny that they ever let Iron Sheik cut promos at all, because he could barely speak English. But that is one of the funnier ones that I've seen. So what happened at the 86 tournament?
Well, the 86 tournament again was at the Foxborough, Massachusetts, also in the summer, July the 14th. Apparently, it was an awful show. The show itself drew 12,000 compared to the year before, and I think. Would you put that down to Parv not having Hogan on the actual card this year?
Hogan was against Volkov, wasn't he, on that first show?
Yes.
And he's missing for this card. And also, Andre's not on the card either?
No, I think the only other non-tournament match on this was the Bulldogs versus, I think, the Dream Team.
I mean, I have looked at a lot of different results over the years, and it seems to me that even as late as kind of 88, 89, Hogan being on the card makes a difference of about 8,000, I would say. It'll turn like a 12,000 gate into 20. So all of those, you know, all of those, I'll give you an example. When they ran it, where it was Ted DiBiase versus Randy Savage for all of 1988, if Hogan's on the card, they were drawing 18 plus. If he wasn't on the card, they were down to 12,000. 10,000, something like that, which isn't a knock on anyone else on the roster. It just, you know, there were that many extra fans who would come out to see Hogan. And the only other guy that I've seen have an effect like that on Gates is Andre the Giant, who, especially before his heel turn, would also add about 8,000 to most Gates. Bruno Sammartino as well, you know, in his heyday, would also make that sort of a difference. But there's very few guys in the history of wrestling who've been able to do that.
No, they are the epitome of a legitimate draw. So the King of the Ring in 1986, here is who was in it. And if you thought 85 was a bit of a mixed bag, we've got Mr. X, Iron Sheik, Billy Jack Haynes, Harley Race, George Steele, Don Morocco, Roddy Piper, Dan Spivey, Nikolai Volkov, Junkyard Dog, Paul Orndorff, Rudy Diamond, and Pedro Morales and Mike Rotundo was our group on this one. And the eventual winner of the 1986 King of the Ring was Harley Race.
Right, and I know there was a draw made for this on TV by President Jack Tunney, which I watched a little bit earlier on. So if you want to see it's fascinating TV, not, because they basically draw each name out of the hat and then go through the brackets of the tournament.
It was like he got his Tom Bowler out, you know, from his Village Fate, and he was, rolling the numbers, doing a bit of bingo or something with that one. But yeah, it wasn't the most capturing TV I've ever seen before.
Yeah, with Ken Resnick, and another former AWA guy. And I think it was from this moment that Harley Race then took on the King gimmick. He actually had a coronation, August the 30th, 1986. And Bobby Heenan acts as the master of ceremonies. Now, I hadn't seen this coronation before. Had you seen it?
No, I hadn't seen this before then either. I mean, this is quite an interesting one, really, seeing who's here. And they did this for the Future King, the heel ones anyway, didn't they? I mean, they did this one for Haku, and they also did it for Macho Man as well, didn't they, where they had a coronation on TV.
Jim Duggan also had one. It's actually quite difficult to track down, but it is there. It's not as classy as the villain ceremonies. It's got the Bushwhackers kind of mugging to the camera, and Duggan cross-eyed with the crown, and, you know, Ventura absolutely hating every second of it on commentary. So, the Duggan ceremony is definitely the least of the four. but it was quite interesting. I watched all four of them back-to-back a little bit earlier, and it was interesting to see who attended, because the Race and the Haku ones were very well attended. I noticed Nikolai Volkov was almost ever present. He seemed to be in all of them.
Well, I think for Race and Haku, you go to Harley Race's coronation because out of respect, you go to Haku's coronation because you're scared what he'd do if you didn't go.
Yes.
I think.
But then it's kind of interesting, the Million Dollar Man is there for Haku's one, for example. So, you know, it was like all of the Andre was there. So all of the kind of, if you think of your villain hierarchy, they were all there. Heenan was obviously leading the show. But then by the time you get to the Macho King, I noticed that it was the Genius who kind of led the coronation. And I noticed that several members of the Heenan family were conspicuous by their absence. There was no Rick Rude. Bobby Heenan wasn't there. Andre wasn't there. The Brainbusters were present, and so was Haku, I noticed. And I thought that was a little bit awkward with Haku standing there as the previous king.
Yeah, I mean, what does he say? Good luck, watch your back, this is going to happen, that's going to happen. You don't know what the conversation they had.
One of the interesting things is that during the Jim Duggan coronation, they do a little kind of insert promo with Haku and the various members of the Heenan family saying, don't worry, you'll get it back, by hook or by crook, you'll get it back. And there he is standing at Savage's one. Yeah,
crestfallen, and but I think with the King of the Ring, I think it really, really helped Harley Race being given the King title and winning that King of the Ring, because apparently Harley saw it as the ultimate compliment that Vince had crowned him the King of the Ring, and I think as well WWF flat out did not recognise any other promotions and you know rarely if ever mentioned anything that happened even in the WWF prior to Vince Jr. taking over. So at the time, they didn't own any NWA footage, which, of course, contained Harley's best work. And because of this, they couldn't bestow a title anymore to say, he's the King of the Ring or he's good at this. But by giving him that King of the Ring title, it elevated him above your standard kind of mid-card WWF journeyman wrestler. So from my point of view, I think it really helped extend his career past what it would have been otherwise.
Yes, and I have seen some older fans really, you know, disparage Vince for doing this to Harley, making it a cartoon and making it a... but, I mean, even if you watch the Hall of Fame speech, Harley Race is still very grateful for that little run. I mean, it extended his career, not just for these 2 years. Who is to say that Harley Race would have definitely had his manager run, which went on for a long time in WCW, if it hadn't been, you know, this basically exposed a whole new generation of fans who then knew who Harley Race was.
No, definitely. I think, you know, it did extend his career, and I don't think he was embarrassed like some historians like to see. I thought he was treated quite well. Realistically, he was never going to be given the strap. He was an older guy. He didn't have the look as such. He could work still, don't get me wrong, but there is no way on earth that, you know, anyone would position him above Hulk Hogan in, you know, the mid-80s. So I think he was looked after. He had a main event run. He had a house show run with Hogan, and I think he made some good money.
Yeah, and I also think he had some of Hogan's better matches in that period. Because, you know, Hogan was often against, you know, big lumbering guys that didn't really play to, you know, it played well off the comeback, but it didn't always play well to necessarily Hogan's strengths. But in Race, he had somebody who he could make a really exciting match with. I mean, even in that match where he injures himself is actually a really good match up until he does that, fall on the table. So...
Yeah, that is a nasty fall on the table. But it's quite interesting that two of Hogan's best opponents in the mid-80s were former NWA champions in Terry Funk and Harley Race.
Yeah, I mean, well, they're almost perfect falls for him. They can sell. They're good to be, you know, when they need to be nasty. I just think that they were some good opponents for him. Now, what do you make of then? So Race gets injured, and Bobby Heenan then makes the announcement that they're making Haku the new king. Now, some people have said that Haku wasn't the best fit for this gimmick. But, I mean, in real life, he was royalty, wasn't he? He was a member of the, you know, of his island. He was, I think, a member of the, you know, he was a prince or something.
He had lineage, but it was never real. Was it ever played up much on TV?
I'm not sure. There was King Tonga, wasn't there?
Yeah.
At some point. I don't know if it was played up, but this may have been some backdoor way of acknowledging it. I actually thought he looked quite cool sitting in the throne with the crown on. But
with his flower tights, his 3/4 length kind of yeah. Islander flower tights. Yeah, it was a good look.
Yeah, and I noticed that DBRC brought one of his better suits. The light almost white silver one that he wore rarely in 1989. So
no, that was more of his that light white one, or the white one was more of a 92 kind of suit that he wore. I mean, stood out to me. Was it SummerSlam 92?
SummerSlam 92. So a very rare outing for that one, for that suit. So
no, it's quite interesting though about Haku. Like you said, Harley Race suffered a hernia injury. And during his absence, Bobby Heenan awarded the crown to Haku. So he didn't win anything. But the interesting thing was, Randy Savage, getting back to what we were talking about before, he won the 1987 King of the Ring tournament. And was it Ted DiBiase won the 1988 one?
Yes.
I believe. So they both won the tournament in storyline, but it was a never acknowledged on TV that they won it. So they've moved away now, the WWF, from promoting the bigger cards, the King of the Ring tournaments, as a special summer event.
And because there's very little video stuff even anywhere on the 87, 88 and 89 tournaments. Scarcely mentioned anywhere from what I can see.
No, you're right there, Anna. It moved in 87, the King of the Ring tournament, to Providence in Rhode Island, and this was realistically it was the unofficial home for King of the Ring, because they ran there 4 years straight. Sorry, not 4 years. 87, 88, 89. They took a break in 1990 and came back in 91. Then they ran in 97 as well. They won a King of the Ring pay-per-view. But the 1987 bracket, so the first round was Randy Savage versus Nikolai Volkoff, Jim Brunzel versus Ron Bass, Danny Davis versus Tito Santana, JYD versus Tama of the Islanders, Beefcake versus Haku, and Rick Martel versus Dan Spivey. So, again, a nice mix of people there.
Yes. It does seem like, looking back, Savage seems like the obvious star in that particular bracket. I guess he was still at IC level in 1987, so...
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing when looking through the results here was Danny Davis beat Tito Santana.
Right.
Then Danny Davis beat the Junkyard Dog.
Wow.
So Danny Davis lost in the semi-final, or semi-finals, as our American friends like to say, to Randy Savage. So he had a little mini kind of run there, did Danny Davis, which is quite surprising.
I think that was an upset against JYD.
Well, there definitely would have been some sort of tomfoolery or distraction in 87 to be beating JYD, but I thought that was quite interesting, and that stood out to me there. And in the finals, it was Savage versus Bundy, looking at the brackets, actually, unless I've... I have missed a bit. I do apologise. Also, in the first round bracket, it was Dan Spivey, SD Jones, Seeker, One Man Gang, and King Kong Bundy.
Right.
So it ended up being Bundy versus Savage in the final. Bundy's still quite... in September 87, so he was still kind of pushed as a main kind of heel figure.
Can I ask, how did SD Jones get on?
He beat Seeker.
He did?
In the first round.
Oh, I'd love to see that match.
That would have been a match for the ages, that's for sure. Probably lasted longer than 5 minutes.
Seeker had a shot against Hogan around, not too far removed from having a shot against Hogan. So I think that's a big upset for that tournament.
So yeah, there's some interesting results in the 87 tournament. So we'll touch on the 88 one, because that kind of covers Haku's reign as the king outside of the tournaments. So the 88 one was from Providence, Rhode Island again, and we had in this one Ted DiBiase, Brutus Beefcake, Ken Patera, Nikolai Volkoff, Ron Bass, Barbarian, Danny Davis again, Shawn Michaels, Hercules, Bad News Brown, Virgil, Randy Savage, Mike Sharp, Boris Zukov, Terry Taylor, and Marty Jannetty. So it was quite a big lineup on this one.
Interesting that Virgil entered the tournament himself.
Yeah, it is actually. He went against Randy Savage in the first round, as I said.
Okay.
With Savage going over there. So it's an interesting one. I mean, they ran 87, 88, and 89. They took a break in 1990, but during that period, Haku lost the kind of crown to Hacksaw Duggan in May of 89, I believe.
Yes.
So you touched on that. I've not seen that coronation.
Mean Gene Okerlund is the master of ceremonies, and they basically there was a lot of very happy characters there. The Bushwhackers, Tito Santana is there. I think the Rockers are there, and they all basically get in a big kind of semicircle around Duggan, and they link arms and do like a little dance. It's a lot more jovial than the than the other ceremonies.
Is it like a jig, or
they kind of do a bit of a jig? I mean, for me, the Bushwhackers were all over it. So there we go. And then there's a moment where Duggan is kind of gives this look as if to say, "Can I really be here with the crown?" You know. So I don't know. I think there's a little bit of disrespect for the ceremony going on from these characters.
was Duggan a transitional king? Because you needed to have a face there to then, you know, be the fodder for the next heel to win the title. So I think maybe Duggan was positioned as the champion, as the king, as a transitional one, because he only held it for, you know, he had the shortest reign out of all of the kings, I believe. And I think he held it till late 89.
Yeah, and then Savage has it from September the 30th of 89 all the way until his retirement in 1991.
Do you think with Savage it helped him having this macho king, or it didn't really matter at that point?
Well, one neat little touch in that ceremony is that the Million Dollar Man gives him the scepter, which I think when I think of the Macho King, I do think of the... because he has a very special crown, doesn't he? He doesn't have the same crown as the others. And that scepter became his go-to weapon, didn't it? And it's even playing into stories as late as, as late as 1991. You know, he's still got that scepter. So I don't know, when I think of... it seems to be more part of his character than it ever was for Duggan, for example. And even for Haku, I mean, King Haku was just Haku with a crown on, whereas Macho King, you know, came with a whole package. Queen Sherry, of course, who was part of the coronation with him. I think it was quite a big part of Savage's character during that period. Would you agree?
No, I think he would. I think it kind of... The King was a heel, and Savage was getting moved down the card a little bit by this point, so he needed something, I felt, to keep him special still, because he was a special talent, he was a former world champion, he main evented the biggest pay-per-view at that point in WWF history, so giving him this kind of king title kept him at a certain level, I feel.
Yes, and there was also this curious alliance with Ted DiBiase. I mean, that moment where he gives him the scepter is also a kind of, if you want to read it this way, a burial of the hatchet. You know, those two had feuded for a long time in 1988, and now all of a sudden they're partners. And they'd keep on, there'd be little kind of moments of that alliance keeps on going all the way till 91. For example, at the Royal Rumble, do you remember the moment where it's almost like DiBiase has paid Savage off and they work together in that stretch of the 1990 Royal Rumble? Do you remember that?
Yeah, no, I do remember that, actually. And that could play into this the kind of story arc of this, and, you know, from him giving him, you know, during the ceremony to that point.
And then, of course, they both team up with Zeus at different times, and then they both feud with Dusty Rhodes at different times. So it's almost like they become virtually linked during that period. Because I think Savage has Zeus at SummerSlam, and then DiBiase has Zeus at Survivor Series. And then I think Savage feuds with Dusty Rhodes for the early part of 1990, and then DiBiase has him for the late part of 1990. So it's almost just an interesting little thing to think about. Because I guess the two, you know, the royalty thing and the money thing, I guess, are... you know, makes them natural allies. Just a little thing to think about.
No, I agree, and I think they were positioned still as two of the main heels. So they would be kind of teaming with Yazusis, who was this kind of guy who was pushed You know, up the card quickly as a kind of threat for Hogan. So they needed someone, you know, an experienced hand to be with him. So I think those two were good choices for that role. But yeah, Savage was an interesting king. And I think, like you said, it helped more than hindered his career. But getting back to the actual King of the Ring kind of brackets, we quickly go through the 89 one now. And we had Akeem, Brutus Beefcake, Hercules, Jim Neidhart, Warlord, Butch Miller from the Bushwhackers, Tito Santana, Bad News Brown, Bill Woods, Rick Martel, Luke Williams from the Bushwhackers, Nikolai Volkoff, The Barbarian, Jimmy Snuka, Haku, and Terry Taylor. And the 89 one was won by Tito Santana. And the final, interestingly, was him versus his old tag team partner, Rick Martel.
Yeah, and I think that's a slight upset, considering, you know, the previous unsuccessful efforts that Tito had had.
Yeah, no, you're right. I think that was a bit of a turn up for the books, him, you know, beating Martel for, in the finals there.
That's the sort of thing that I'd have read in, you know, PWI and been like, ooh, it's interesting that Tito Santana would be winning this big tournament. So
yeah, well, yeah, they didn't have one in 1990 for whatever reason. There could be scheduling conflicts. Looking at the time, October 1990. That jumps out at me as a date. I don't know when WWF ran that show with All Japan at the Dome. Could be completely out of my time with my time frame there, but they may have been doing something more pressing in 1990 than running a non-televised tournament in Providence, Rhode Island. But if any listeners know why specifically there wasn't one ran in 1990, be sure to let us know. And the final one of this era of shows, pre-pay-per-view, was The King of the Ring in 1991. So this is more, obviously, 1990 workers. So in this one, we had Hawk of Legion of Doom, Jerry Sags, Ricky Steamboat, Ted DiBiase, Brian Knobbs, Jim Duggan, The Berserker, Irwin R. Scheister, Virgil, Skinner, Bret Hart, Pete Doherty, Sid Justice, The Warlord, Animal, and The Undertaker.
So I'm very surprised that the Duke of Dorchester made it to that tournament.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you don't know how over he was in Providence. You know. he was... interestingly, disposed of quite easily by Bret Hart in the first round, who went on to win it. But looking at the results here, Jerry Sags beat Hawk in the first round.
That's a big upset.
So that, regardless of, you know, positioning, I would be very surprised that Hawk's going to lay down and do the job for someone, you know, like that, without there being a meaning for it, even in 91.
Was it a pinfall or a countout?
It's not listed here, but I would imagine it wouldn't have been a pinfall. I really think it would have been a count out or something like that. Some interference maybe by Jimmy Hart. And the other first round match that is available on handheld PAV, I don't know if you've ever tracked it down, is the Ricky Steamboat Ted DiBiase match.
Yes.
Have you had a chance to watch that match ever?
I have. It was a Holy Grail match for me for a very long time. And this is a good week to talk about Holy Grails, of course.
Oh, yeah.
topical. But, yeah, it's a very disappointing match. It's a 15-minute draw. And it's very... how shall we say, chin-locky. I don't think either of them were trying to put on the best match for the night. We'll just put it that way.
I think the other interesting first round or match-up in the second round, was Sid Justice versus The Undertaker. Sid Justice went over the Warlord, which would have been a five-star classic, and Undertaker beat Animal. So Animal and Hawk both went out in the first round.
I find, very surprised. I'm sure that there was, I wouldn't be surprised if the Nasty Boys did a run-in or something, you know.
On each one, to continue their kind of program.
Yeah, something along those lines, because it seems very unusual for the Road Warriors ever to be pinned.
No, I think that would probably sound, you know, more believable if it went that way. So Bret Hart had an easy run in a way. So he beat Pete Doherty in the first round, second round, Skinner. Third round, he had a bye because Sid Justice and Undertaker went to a double DQ. And in the finals, it was him versus Irwin R. Scheister, IRS. So it was, just, in a way, Bret Hart had an easier run in 91 than he did in 1993.
Yes. I mean, IRS was fairly well pushed, I would say, in 1991.
Well, he was new. I mean, he made his debut in 91, I believe. Was it late 90 or early 91?
I think his first match is against Greg Valentine. I want to say, or one of his very early matches is, and that's at SummerSlam, I believe.
In 91, yeah. So we came in the summer of 91. This was, he just started wearing these brown trousers. I don't know if you've ever seen those brown trousers, Paul.
Yes, I have.
Yeah. And he moved more into the kind of traditional look that he was known for. But him versus Bret Hart in 91, I don't think that would have been a great match, personally. I don't know about you.
Well, who knows? I mean, that's probably online as well. But I can't see it being, who knows? Irwin did like the abdominal stretch and the reverse chin lock, as we all know. okay, well, I think we've had a really good look at the King there, so I hope Graham Nelson from Calgary in Alberta is happy. And, we'll be back next time with more questions. If fans want to write in, Alan, how can they get hold of us?
I think the best way of getting hold of us is reaching out to us on our Twitter accounts. There's one way. So with myself, my Twitter handle, if anyone wants to follow me or ask me a question or tell me I don't know what I'm on about, it's Alan_cheapshot. So that's Alan spelled A-L-L-A-N. And how can people follow you on Twitter, Parv?
I am at Jerry Von K. That's the letter K. So Jerry Von K. So if you found somebody with a picture of Sean Mooney, you've found the right person, and you can write.
Are you sure that's Sean Mooney?
Yes, that is a topic that we may return to in future weeks.
So that's one way you can check us out on Twitter. But also, we want to thank the guys at Place to Be Nation. How can people find more about Place to Be Nation, Parv?
Well, I think I'd visit the main site, placetobenation.com, where you'll find lots of different things, podcasts, articles about wrestling, sports, comics, and everything else. So if you haven't checked out any of those shows, do so, and we will welcome you back next week. We're going to come every Thursday. That's our plan.
Remember, this Monday night, fans, at Foxborough Stadium, Sullivan Stadium's the name of the stadium, but it's Foxborough, Massachusetts. This man, the Iron Sheik, is one of those in the 16-man elimination tournament to find the King of the Ring. Winner to get a beautiful trophy, plus the prestige of this big tournament, plus Hulk Hogan against Volkov for the title, Monday night, Foxborough.
You know, Freddie Miller, Foxborough, Massachusetts, or Boston Garden, or that area, people crazy about wrestling. And also, we have a lot of prejudiced people. Anytime we wrestling Boston Garden, anytime wrestling in the Providence, we saw thousand American flag, and everybody call USA, USA, Hulkamanian, Paul Androff, whatever. But remember, Foxborough, Massachusetts. Nicola and Avi are ready. We just get back from the gym, and every human being know Hulk Hogan, that belt you have was mine. Now, my partner, Russian man, Nicola, the strongest man in the world, he is ready. Foxborough, Massachusetts. I hope you American, all American state, Massachusetts, you have enough gasoline to you make it today. Foxborough, Massachusetts. Because Nicola promised me to get that belt from that idiot Hulk Hogan. And then I don't have to talk about myself. Every human being know I'm a king of the wrestling since 18 years old. Now, I heard they bring the Steamboat, they bring that idiot Junkyard Dog, Paul Androff, that Mexican Santaro, to find out who is the best in that tournament. I proved it since 18 years old, and still I'm going to show it again. Foxborough, Massachusetts, look at me. Cameraman, zoom.
This Monday night, 7:30, be there.